Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by contributors from community radio stations across Canada. This episode of Groundwire was produced at CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on occupied Anishinaabe Akin, the homeland of the Métis Nation and the historical territory of the Nahiawak and the Nakota. We are your hosts. My name is Susan Hubert.
And my name is Heather Shack. On today's show...
So again, classic hydro. When people in the north want to present the facts, they immediately want to dismiss it, obscure it, or not even be heard.
I mean, last year, you know, at the UN, Justin Trudeau did pretty much the exact same thing, and nothing, right? What has he really accomplished since then?
But first, here are our headlines. The following headline comes from Catherine Fisher of CJLY on Sinaixt Traditional Territory in BC.
In July, West Coast Environmental Law and more than 50 other organizations sent a letter to BC Premier John Horgan asking the province to enact the Liability for Climate-Related Harm Act. The letter explains that as a result of fossil fuel pollution, the world has already seen a 1 degree increase in average temperatures, which has caused an increase in droughts, wildfires, and water shortages in BC. Extreme weather and early melting of snowpack, leading to flooding, landslides, and resident evacuation, sea level rise, requiring expensive coastal protection measures, and the spread of diseases and pest species such as Lyme's disease and the mountain pine beetle. All of these climate impacts hit poor and vulnerable groups especially hard. And as global temperatures increase, they're predicted to get worse. Estimates of future costs to the British Columbia government run in the tens of billions of dollars. The proposed Liability for Climate-Related Harm Act, which is modeled on BC laws that define the legal liability of tobacco companies for cigarette deaths, would confirm that global fossil fuel companies must pay their share of the climate-related costs to BC communities. Similar legislation has been proposed in Ontario.
Robert Latimer announced last month that he was seeking a pardon or new trial over the 1993 killing of his daughter Tracy. Tracy Latimer had been 12 at the time of her death and living with cerebral palsy. Her father framed his action as an act of mercy to spare his daughter from a life of pain and suffering. Heidi Dance is an adjunct professor at the University of Alberta, specializing in disability ethics. Dance disclosed the disturbing implications of complying with Latimer's request for a pardon.
It would essentially create two classifications for homicide. And in cases where somebody with disabilities who was killed, the murderer would get off. Either with the light sentence or no sentence.
Professor Jantz also notes how the new physician-assisted death laws in Canada should not apply to the Latimer case.
It is legal for people whose death is reasonably foreseeable.
Tracy had
a long-term condition.
She wasn't dying.
Thank you to the CKUT Community News Collective for supplying the audio from that interview. That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this.
Sometimes it hurts to be indigenous, born in this nation. Not enough to talk about decolonization. In the battles with myself, I'm continually facing. Feel the stress of the world on my shoulders, I'm fading. But I ain't going out yet, cause this is just the outset. And I ain't making change if I'm rapping about an outfit. Unless it's that camo, intelligence is ammo. Modern day warrior, just call me Rambo. Not trying to be deceitful, cause mostly I'm peaceful. But getting sick and tired of being seen as unequal. So I'm waiting for the pitch as I'm stepping to the plate. They saying that we bitch, but we live in second rate. Well, they don't like the truth, so that's what I'm coming with. Reppin' for the youth, yup, that's who I'm running with. Don't represent a leadership or represent empowerment. Working on the ground, cause I have issues with the government. Who issue out apologies while sticking to the...
You are listening to Groundwire Community Radio News. available online at www.groundwirenews.ca. You just heard They Say by Manitoba-based MC singer-songwriter Leonard Sumner from the 2013 album Res Poetry.
Now it's time for our feature stories. Cities around the globe recognized Hiroshima Day with ceremonies calling for peace and disarmament. Michael Welch of radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg brings us the following report on the events hosted in two Canadian cities.
It was on August 6, 1945, that the U.S. Boeing B-29 Superfortress Enola Gay dropped the 4.4 metric ton atomic bomb, codenamed Little Boy, on the Japanese city of Hiroshima, destroying most of the city and marking the dawn of the nuclear age. The horror of that event was repeated 3 days later when the USAAF B-29 bomber Boxcar dropped a second atomic bomb, codenamed Fat Man, on the city of Nagasaki. In all, the combined assaults are estimated to have claimed the lives of between 129,000 and 226,000 people, not including the deaths due to cancers and other sicknesses related to the attacks. During the week of August 6, 2018, the anniversary of the attacks was marked with commemoration ceremonies around the globe. In Winnipeg, on the 73rd anniversary of the Hiroshima bombing, several dozen community members gathered in the city's Memorial Park, proximate to the Manitoba Legislative Building, to participate in the annual Lanterns for Peace ceremony. Festivities at the Winnipeg event included a recitation of the Hiroshima mayor's message and a retelling of the story of Sadako and 1,000 Paper Cranes, about a 10-year-old girl who believed that by making 1,000 paper cranes, she could be granted the wish of being cured of her illness stemming from the bombing. The last presentation by Ellen Judd of the Winnipeg Quakers was an appeal to Canadians to take action on a draft treaty to abolish nuclear weapons, which was introduced through a vote at the United Nations General Assembly in 2017. Judd explained that although the known nuclear states have refrained from signing the treaty and Canada has yet to sign on, pressuring the Canadian government was a worthwhile endeavor.
What a treaty signifies is a threshold in a process of building a movement to accomplish some kind of change. So we can think, for example, to the legacy of World War I and the movement to abolish chemical and biological weapons. We're certainly under a great deal of pressure. The countries that I just named, in particular the United States and Great Britain, are pressuring their allies, not their military allies, not to sign, and these are our close allies. But it's also the case that Canada has resisted this kind of pressure. We haven't had nuclear weapons permanently on Canadian territory since 1984. We didn't send Canadian troops to Vietnam or in 2003 to Iraq. So Canada can, in fact, take these independent decisions.
Lanterns decorated by participants at the start of the event were launched into the fountain pond at dusk, marking the end of the ceremony for 2018. The following day, Tuesday, August 7th, Chris Cook of CFUV's Guerrilla Radio commented on that city's local Hiroshima Day commemoration as it was happening.
There's a commemoration going on by the Women in Black, silent recognition and remembrance of the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945. It's a smaller group than usual, the heat forbidding some of the mainly older members of the Women in Black. So I've been seconded to holding one end of the large banner, Women in Black Creating a World Without Violence. Beneath our feet there's chalk markings, abolish nuclear weapons, remember Hiroshima, world for peace now, and stop uranium mining, something in Canada that is Canada has been doing for a very long time and still yet. A sustained call for peace and disarmament, reiterated today as it is every year by the Women in Black in this very spot at the tourism center in the Inner Harbor of Victoria. Today is a beautiful example of a summer day, too beautiful maybe. The heat has kept away some of the members of the Women in Black, but a game corps contingent has arrived again and are providing example of the continued vigilance for their cause, handing leaflets out to the mostly tourists that are wandering around here at the high noon. It's interesting to see, though, you know, for the most part, the world just ambles by, oblivious to both the past, the present, and desperate to ignore the future ramifications of world economies constructed on the fragile foundations of perpetual warfare.
Listeners wishing to take action for disarmament and the abolition of nuclear weapons can find resources at the site www.icanw.org. From Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe Akin, the homeland of the Métis Nation and the historical territory of the Nihiowak and the Nakota, this is CKUW's Michael Welch for Groundwire.
Our final feature comes from Montreal's CKUT 90.3 FM, broadcasting on the unceded Kanien-Kahaka territory. CKUT's July 31st edition of Off the Hour hosted a panel discussion on Canada's Human Rights Review with representatives for sex workers, Muslim women, Indigenous people, and anti-poverty groups. What follows are highlights from that conversation.
My name is Ali Sirwa. Joining us today is longtime CKUT contributor Sama Ali Biari, who will be speaking with representatives from different Montreal communities on Canada's recent Human Rights Review at the UN.
On May 11, 2018, Canada appeared before the United Nations Human Rights Council for its third Universal Periodic Review, UPR-3, during which Canada's human rights record was examined by other UN member states. A record 107 member states participated in the review, resulting in 275 recommendations for Canada to improve its human rights situation. Canada must now provide a formal response to the UN Human Rights Council by the end of August 2018, indicating which of the recommendations Canada will and will not accept. We are going to listen to Judy Wilson-Raybould, Minister of Justice and Attorney General of Canada at the United Nations, May 11, 2018.
Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced earlier this year that the Government of Canada will develop, in full partnership with Indigenous, or with First Nations, Inuit, and Métis peoples, a recognition and implementation of rights framework as the basis for all relations with Indigenous peoples and the federal government.
On the line with us is Nakuset, Executive Director, Native Women's Shelter. Your comments.
It's same old, you know. I mean, last year, you know, at the UN, Justin Trudeau did pretty much the exact same thing and nothing, right? What has he really accomplished since then? In April, I sent a letter to Justin Trudeau, to Jody Raybould, and to the Justice Minister, asking them all the exact same letter, saying, because you are committed to helping Indigenous people, we are building a second stage housing for Indigenous women and children in Montreal. It is the only one that that could exist in Montreal, and you should be behind us, backing us, providing some funding for it. They never responded to my letter. Well, I think every Indigenous person should write her today and see something concrete, because we're not seeing that.
Provincial examples of pay equity measures include the introduction by the Government of Ontario of a new Pay Transparency Act in 2018. Governments also continue to strengthen Canada's capacity to apply the gender and diversity lens to policymaking.
On the line with us from Ottawa, Amira El-Gawabi, board member of the Canadian Anti-Hate Network. She's also a journalist. Amira is a visible minority woman wearing the hijab.
Women who wear the headscarf, while they may have a higher proportion of post-secondary education, when compared to the general population, their employment will be far less than the general than other women in the general population. Similarly, for instance, if you look at Indigenous women or Black women, you will also have similar rates of lower participation in employment. And so you're absolutely right that it is critical that when the federal government is, you know, talking about employment, participation, equal participation, pay equity, all of these different efforts that they are undertaking and say that they're undertaking to ensure that women have greater participation overall in society, that they are taking in these specific characteristics that are going to have an additional impact on how successful women are in this country.
As part of the federal government's commitment to creating better and fairer immigration detention system, in 2016, we launched a new framework for immigration detention.
In the studio with us, we have Patrick de Gruyter, Project Coordinator, St. Columba House, and also Sandra Wesley, Director Stella House.
Of course, it's interesting that we're talking about forced migration and then immediately security is brought into this, which is not necessarily an association that one would have when one works with refugees.
In Canada, we have an immigration regulation that says that anyone who doesn't have permanent residency, no matter their status or lack of status, if they're found in a place where sex work is happening, they can be deported. And this is a major problem that we're seeing across the country. Colleagues in Toronto and Vancouver have done surveys with Asian migrant sex workers, and they found that 100% of them said they would never call the police, no matter what violence they experienced. We hear that there's this human rights-based approach to housing, this strategy, yet somehow we're still living in a city where we have concerted strategies on the municipal, provincial, and even sometimes federal level to, clean up downtown before sporting events or before major festivals to make it look nicer for tourists and to get homeless people out of public view. When we're talking about people who have other intersecting oppressions, who are living very complicated lives, we need a lot more than simply providing housing. As long as we just have these big top-down policies, even with money, in the end, we still leave a large section of people out in the cold.
We hope that we will continue this conversation very soon and find out what is Canada going to accept as recommendations for its review at the UN.
That report was provided by CKUT in Montreal on unceded Kanien-Kahaka territory. You are still listening to Groundwire, community news broadcasting from coast to coast to coast, and available online at www.groundwirenews.ca.
Now it's time for our community radio report. This episode's community radio report comes from Ome Salma Ramchula on the traditional territories of the Mississaugas of the New Credit.
The National Campus and Community Radio Association, the NCRA, is made up of member stations from across the country and is governed through a board of directors. In the 1990s, the board created a designated seat for an Indigenous representative from the First Nations, Métis, and Inuit communities on the NCRA board. At this year's annual general meeting of the NCRA, an Indigenous representative was not elected and now needs to be filled through a by-election. However, this is now the second round of call-outs for a nomination, pointing to a systemic issue within the NCRA and the campus and community radio sector. Gennardio Sullivan, from member station CFRO Vancouver Co-op Radio, held the Indigenous seat of the NCRA board for 1 year in 2012 and 13.
I think it's very important to get on this board at a national level because without any representation, nothing gets done. When you sit on a board at this level, it takes a whole community of broadcasters, of programmers, even stations to a whole new level of awareness about First Nations issues and some of the obstacles that we face as programmers. It allows you to represent at a national level. It allows you to build relationships with station members. Once you have built those relationships with these stations, then you can begin to build an initiative from station to station, from region to region. And I think that the most important thing that it allows you to make change at the highest level possible and at the most meaningful level. If you commit to being on the board, you can represent First Nations people, needs, and issues. You can change policies and procedures. You can have influence on the rest of the board.
During her time on the board, Ganarji led the NCRA's Resonating Reconciliation Project, aimed at increasing Indigenous representation in community radio at local stations by providing resources for stations to recruit and train Indigenous producers.
This new initiative called Resonating Reconciliation would allow the NCRA to build partnership with the Red John Slam Society and also engage 40 stations across Canada at a community and campus level to recruit 1 to 2 radio broadcasters and producers, and the stations would provide training in editing and field recording and in interviewing skills. So this is a great initiative. It did two things. One is it fleshed out those Native people already working at the station who could benefit from this funding initiative, and also allowed them to go out and find new blood, so to speak. And out of that, there were 70 radio documentaries produced.
Though the project was a resounding success, it wasn't able to sustain Indigenous participation in local community radio stations long term, pointing to a larger issue of inclusivity in campus community radio.
So my only issue with the NCRA, if you even want to call it an issue, is that here we had a Resonating Reconciliation Project, a nationwide project which engaged at the least 40 new First Nations broadcasters and producers who had already built a relationship with whichever stations that they had been contracted to work with. Why have those stations not maintained those relationships with those programmers? Why, after all of these years, do we not see a bigger presence? And I think that is the problem, that it lays not only on the stations, but on, you know, also those newly recruited First Nations producers and broadcasters. We have to be able to reach back and forth to each other and keep those relationships going. You know, and I really wish that each station would commit to going to the knowledge keepers and the cultural keepers of their territory that they are broadcasting from, ask them if they would do a recording for you, a welcoming in their language of that territory, so that you can begin each day in a good way, recognizing the territory that you are broadcasting from.
This is not the first time that the NCRA has been incapable of filling the Indigenous board seat, though they have not been able to acknowledge the underlying reasons for this. I spoke with current NCRA Board Secretary Catherine Fisher about this issue and asked her why this problem persists. Catherine is from member station CJLY in Nelson, BC, and has been on and off the NCRA Board of Directors for over 5 years and has been involved with community radio across the country since 1987.
I wish I could give you an answer to that. I would like to know the answer to that. Certainly, speaking as the secretary of the current board, we would like that seat to be filled in this election. I mean, I'm sure the reasons are complex and many. I can only speak for the current board in saying that we would like there to be a person in the seat, and we would like the NCRA to be a welcoming place for any station that wants to be involved, and any person from any station that wants to be involved. If we can improve, we welcome hearing that from people. Personally, and I'm not speaking as the board secretary anymore, just speaking personally, I think it's always a challenge to find a good balance for equity within the NCRA. It's one of the harder things to figure out on the board, in my personal opinion.
The second bylaw nomination period for the Indigenous seat closes on August 27th, with member stations voting by email between August 30th and September 5th.
If people are interested in participating in the by-election, they just need the support of their member station, and they can just email me at secretary@ncra.ca. That's also posted on the NCRA's website if people want the details of that.
Reporting for Groundwire from the traditional territories of the Mississaugas of the New Credit, this is Ome Salma Rahimtula.
That was our community radio report. Up next, a short musical break.
just heard Swim by Manitoba artist Tansy from her 2018 album Swim Sleep.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced at CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on occupied Anishinaabe Akin, the homeland of the Métis Nation and the historical territory of the Nahiawak and the Nakota. Headlines this week were written by Catherine Fisher and Michael Welch. We also thank Michael Welch, Chris Cook, Paul Graham, the CKUT News Collective, and Omi Salman Rahmtula for their contributions. Music this week was from Leonard Sumner and Tansy. For CKUW, I'm Susan Hubert.
And I'm Heather Schack. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at groundwirenews.ca. Thanks for tuning in.